Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of thee. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze. This is my country, land of my birth. This is my country, grandest on earth. I pledge my allegiance, America, the bold, for this is my country to have and to
Circumcision, the unkindest cut of all, controversy here in San Francisco and in California. And it's interesting because the San Francisco government, the Board of Supervisors, or what would be city councilman or assemblyman, depending on what part of the country you are, that's what these people are trying to, or at least a couple of them are trying to stop circumcision of males at the hospitals. Now, it's interesting, unfortunately, no pun intended, something happened. I uploaded the file, and apparently it's been cut off, no pun intended. But we'll have this Monday, because it's an hour-long interview that was in the archives, and so we have to cut it up. I don't know why it didn't go up or what happened. But anyway, what's interesting is one of the people, one of the nurses behind the anti-circumcision happened to be Jewish. I don't know if she practiced. Miss London, who lived in, not related to Julie London, the singer, lived in Marin County. Now, it's interesting at San Francisco General, where a lot of these anchor babies are suspected, anchor babies, and other poor people who had their babies delivered at San Francisco General Hospital, which is a public hospital, a lot of the rates of circumcision have dropped. Now, during the during the days of the hippies, it was the end thing to keep children, male children, quote, intact. And, of course, there was, even growing up in the 50s and 60s, a intact male, when other males in the shower room after a physical exercise or football team or baseball team, was considered to be a joke among his peers if he was intact. And that was the thing, and it was embarrassing for some males. But it's an interesting issue that the San Francisco government should get involved in this, or members of the government, when this is required among the Islamic faiths and the Jewish faiths, although there are some Jews who don't believe in this type of circumcision, and certain Reform Jews have just a minimal cut. Now, those of you who remember Sammy Davis Jr. when he converted to Judaism, he was an adult, so they didn't do the same type of operation on him that they would, or any other adult male, that they would do on a baby. So there is a ceremonial cut. I forgot which part of the body that was. Now, during the Nazi period, and even the Russian czars' pogroms in Russian-occupied countries, when they were going after Jews, they'd make them drop their pants to see if they were circumcised or cut. Now, what had happened in the Warsaw Ghetto, and part of my family is European Jewish, what would happen is there was a foreskin restoral going on, so that these people who would ordinarily be identified as Jewish because they were circumcised, these males, were, quote, intact. Also, this is not reported widely in the American press, that among the gays and even some straight guys who have been circumcised at birth or as children are involved in this foreskin restoral, and it's quite interesting. I would think it's quite painful. And also during one of the reasons the military insisted upon this, they used such phrases as cut your flaps and all of that, that there was a high rate of high incidence of venereal disease, and so when a young male was drafted or recruited, if he was uncircumcised, that he was sent off to the military doctor to be cut, and it's also used as a threat. Some commanding officers would threaten their subordinates with a trip to the doctor for circumcision if they violated their commanding officer's orders or were not good soldiers or sailors, whatever. So there's quite a bit of history behind this. Also, when the British expeditionary forces were in places like India, and the famous movie about Lord Clive of India, the guy who made it possible for the British to engage in economic imperialism in the subcontinent in the 17th century. Before the British East India Company sent out their young males, they had them circumcised, because otherwise, if they were captured by the Indians, one of the first things they would do to them would be to brutally circumcise them without any anesthesia. Now, there's reported cases even today, but there were cases of the British officers, British military personnel, who were captured by Islamists, and they were given a half circumcision, very brutal. Now, also, I did interview some Russian soldiers who had served in Afghanistan. They were here in San Francisco, and we didn't quite get into that topic, but from what I've been told by people who have served over there and are familiar with the brutal history of the Islamists, that even the Russian soldiers, if they weren't circumcised, they were forcibly circumcised and forced to become Islamized. So there's quite a bit of history, and it's colorful and brutal. And we'll get into part of this when I don't know what happened when we uploaded the segment today. It's been pretty rough. We've been had to take care of several emergencies. Since we lost this, we're going to replay Will Rogers, because we're hearing all this hot air. We could use some hot air because it's cold, about government plans. So Will Rogers is probably the last of the really funny and not vicious political satirists, unlike the crowd we have today who seem to have vitriol in their veins. So here's Will Rogers commenting on government plans. I don't know what happened here. What is going on here? Let's try. I can't explain this. Oh, damn it. Excuse my French. Well, let's...
this country there is not who shall be relieved and whose money shall relieve him, but who shall be the one that plays Santa Claus and actually hands out the presents, you know? That's the main part from the day, is who hands out the presents. Here he says, he should wear the whiskers. And if you can, Mr. Hopkins, they say no, we've got sleigh bells ourselves. Governor Talmadge, down in Georgia, he had a plan. It hit a rut and knocked him right out of the bread line last week. Now, it's been a bad week on plans all around. I'm not going to get discouraged, though. In fact, these other failures, well, they've given me confidence, you know? More hope that my plan will be a success. Now, my plan, to state it in a nutshell, and in fact, that's where all plans come from. And the nut should never be cracked. But here is my plan in a nutshell. My plan is a plan to end all plans. It's to do away with all plans. That's what it is. There ain't but one place that a plan is any good and that it'll really work, and that's on paper. But the minute you get it off a sheet of paper and get it out in the air and it blows away, that's what it is. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, he dragged more of these school marms out of little red schoolhouses.
Will Rogers got cut off, but I wonder what he would say today if he were living today, what he would tell Nancy Pelosi or Mr. Rowe about, quote, their plans, or Steny Hoyer and some of these other people, Mr. Weiner from New York, and that lady with the great contralto voice. She should have been a singer from Florida, a Jewish woman, left us, what he would tell her. And he can do it, and he would have done it in a human way. Now, when he referred to Harry Hopkins was advisor to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of his close advisors, like Axelrod was to Obama, although Hopkins had ethics, and Axelrod, there's a lot of questions about him. So what we're going to do to we have to dance on our feet here. We'll just play some other things. Now, it's interesting that with all the name-calling and the Tea Party people have been called racist and all that, Otto Butz, the late president of Golden Gate University, he born in Romania, German family, emigrated to Toronto, Canada, went to Princeton, and ended up in California. Author of several books, professor of political science. I interviewed him on Animal Illusions. It's interesting that you don't hear politicians from either side of the aisle call each other jackasses or morons or there are other names that were used in the early part of this country to by political opponents to describe their adversaries. And even the newspapers were very vitriolic in some of their descriptions and the language they used. So here's Otto Butz. I think this is very relevant because it also adds color to political description of political discourse.
Hello again, my friends. Welcome to part two of our inaugural inquiry into animal rights and people's language. My guest today, again, is the eminent Otto Butz, president of Golden Gate University and what we call the house etymologist around here. Otto, after an election, both print and electronic journalists continually use the trite phrase, lame duck politician. As a political scientist, Otto, do you think that these journalists are really saying that our politicians are impotent, ruptured, and babbling incoherence?
Well, I think to some extent, yes. A lame duck, I guess, is a duck that can't fly very high, that can't move very fast, and once a politician has lost the power to continue functioning and to dole out favors. The person's power is much reduced, and so the analogy of the lame duck isn't too bad at all.
Perhaps we ought to cook the duck like the Chinese.
Well, again, back to our previous discussion, it has nothing to do with the duck, but you see, you need analogies to describe human situations, and so you naturally turn around to nature, but the most interesting part of nature is the animal kingdom, and again, I think that it adds color. You could describe in a whole paragraph what happens to the politician, but if you say lame duck, somehow you dramatize it and you see this poor little critter.
I don't know about the politicians being poor.
Well, I tell you, politicians, I think for the most part, don't get paid very much, and that's one of the problems of our time. I mean, to run a campaign costs you millions of dollars, and how are you going to get it? And that, you've got to be nice to people, and then we criticize others. But if we were to run for office, how would you finance all of that? So this is one of the dilemmas of our political life, you know, lame or non-lame ducks.
Although I must say, some politicians do appear to be babbling. Constantly. Otto, for people who want to elevate the level of political rhetoric, would you have any practical suggestions?
Well, elevate political rhetoric. I mean, rhetoric is rhetoric, however elevated. You mean the political discussion.
Yes.
I think that the market more or less tends to determine the level of the rhetoric. If a politician is talking with thoughtful people with a sense of complexities, if she or he engages in stupid rhetoric, it's not going to fly. So the politician, if successful, as any merchandiser, has to attune himself or herself to the audience. On the other hand, if you've got a bunch of people who go for rhetoric, then the politician is going to play rhetoric. I think it's a question of supply and demand.
And on that, we'll end this segment of the discussion on animal rights and language. I think that's very apropos. Tune in for part 3, next edition at 10:25 a.m. Thanks for listening.
Now, Otto mentioned politicians have to scrape around, search for money. And the question that George Christopher, who also attended Golden Gate College when it was a college, or the YMCA college, got his accounting degree and started Christopher Dairies. Before he died, we did a series of interviews and a TV shoot, and we got into what he wanted his legacy to be. And this is a repeat, by the way, but it's very relevant today because the politicians who have been turned out or defeated, some of them are walking away with quite a bit of money. So they have more money when they left office or are leaving office than when they came into office. So where did that money come from? They apparently enriched themselves while in office. And I think this is very relevant, and this is something for the ages. George Christopher's recommendations to all politicians, you know, how they should behave in office and how they should leave office. They shouldn't use it as a enrichment, a way to enrich them, use public service as a way to get rich.
What do you want your legacy to be? What do you want people to remember you for?
Well, I don't even give that any thought. I'll be remembered for whatever, if I'm remembered at all.
You will be. We'll make sure of that.
I don't know if I'll be remembered, but I just feel that every mayor should care for everybody. I was raised south of Market. We lived in a house in the same building. There was a Negro family there. In those days, we called them Negroes. We didn't call them blacks or African Americans. In one flat, there was a Negro family. The other two flats, there were two Chinese families. We were in another flat. It never occurred to us that we should treat one another differently. And I think it's necessary to bear in mind that anybody who is elected the mayor of the city has a solemn obligation to not to think about how he's going to be remembered, but what can he do to for a better city. And one of the things I think you have to bear in mind is he should be the very epitome of complete, total, unequivocal integrity. And the reason I say that is because on two different occasions, I was bequeathed money. And the first time it was $20,000. I didn't even know the man. He passed away. He left the money in his will. They brought the check up to me. And I said, what is it for? He says, well, it's in his will. He says, he likes the way you operate the city. He was a Slavonian. Never met the man. I inquired further. I said, what was his physical condition? Well, he was half blind, either completely blind or half blind. So I told him, I said, I'm not going to accept the money. Well, why not? The reason I'm not going to, and I knew, I thought I was laying the foundation for future mayors to also do likewise, if necessary. I said, I'm not going to accept the money only because I'm not a relative of his. He doesn't know me, never met the man. The only reason he is leaving me this money is because I am the mayor. So I'm a non-entity as far as he's concerned, except that he thinks I ran the city in a pretty good way. So here's what I want you to do. I said, I want you to give $5,000 to the Shriners for the kids out in 19th Avenue. $5,000 to the Catholic charities, $5,000 to the Jewish charities, and $5,000 to the Association for the Blind. Gave it all away, you see. That was the first time. The first time was $20,000. Now, that made an impression with the press, too, I'm sure, because the press had to say, well, this guy is not here for the money. This fellow's here to maybe do some good. Second time was a fellow who passed away, and the Wells Fargo Bank at 9th and Market called me and said, we are supposed to open this box after a certain time, period of time. You're supposed to open up a safe deposit box, and whatever is in there is yours, because that's the will. So I got Judge Vilboris to come with me. He was a judge then. No, he wasn't a judge. He was an attorney. But I forget now what he was or was not. But anyway, he was a good friend. I trusted him. I said, you better come down with me because I don't know what this means. This is a new experience for me. We went down to the 9th and Market at Wells Fargo Bank, I think it's still there. Opened the box and it was $38,000 in cash there. All in cash. And the manager said, well, it's yours. You want to open an account here? And well, I had an account here too. You want to put it in your account? And I said, no. I don't want to do that either. I said, I need a little time to think about it. And I came home, I told my wife about it. I said, you know, I said, I don't think we ought to keep this money. I opened an account, but I call it the Christopher Trust for, with this man's name. So I'd be alleviated from that responsibility. And I got my wife to bring out all the old Christmas cards, and I got my old Christmas cards out, and all the people that I knew. And I sent them all over the country. I sent about 80 or 90 letters throughout the country. And I didn't hear anything for about 2 months, but about 2 or 3 months later, I received a telephone call from a lady from Evanston, Illinois. She said, "I'm Nick's half-sister." Well, that's interesting. Half-sister. "So what's your name?" And, "Well, I got all the details." And Jim Purcell at that time was my attorney. I went to see him. I said, "Jim, another problem here, $38,000 all in cash." And this fellow was a professional wrestler. You see. But not the big, not the top level fellows. One of these preliminary wrestlers. And every time he'd go to Watsonville or any small town, he'd get a fee of $500 or $600. He'd keep $100 for himself and put the rest in the box. So as a result, he accumulated $38,000. And finally, one day I get this call from Evanston. This lady said she was a half-sister. And we brought her out. In the meantime, before she came out, Jim Purcell did a lot of investigating work to be sure that she really was. And we finally found out, determined, well, through all the legal process, that she was a half-sister. We wrote letters and telegrams and all that sort of thing. And then brought her out and gave her after more interrogation, gave her the money. I gave her the entire $38,000. And on the way to the airport to send her back home, my wife and I took her down. And I said, "Tell me, what do you do? Oh, no, do you have a family?" She says, "I'm a widow," she said. "And what kind of a family do you have?" She says, "I have two teenage daughters. One is 12 and one is 14 years of age." Oh, I said, "That's nice. And what do you do? Do you work?" She says, "Yes, I work in a hospital." And I said, what do you do there, if I may ask?" Oh, she said, "I'm ashamed to tell you." I said, "Well, I don't know why you should be ashamed if you're working." She says, "I clean the bedpans." Well, you know, my heart bled and my wife's heart bled, too. I said to myself, how much good would have it done me to keep the money, like the banker suggested? Here you bring this woman who never saw me before, haven't seen her since, but she sent me a Christmas card. And these are the things you ask, what should a mayor do? He should be compassionate with intelligence, not compassionate recklessly, just with some intelligent viewpoint of what constitutes humanity. And if you do that, then you can leave office after 8 years like I did and have no regrets. And the only regret I have today is when somebody, for political purposes, as I mentioned before about that Mill case, they should never have done that to me. That's vicious politics, you see. Because they say Christopher violated the Milk Law. I didn't violate the Milk Law. The law had been declared unconstitutional. So how in the name of, so they had a lie, didn't they? They had a lie to put me in a difficult spot. But finally, when I wrote that book, it's in there. I exposed the whole thing. And the Examiner, as I said before, once had an editorial saying that Christopher wants to reduce the price of milk to the school kids, and the milk industry was fighting it. But these are the things you have to endure, the good and the bad, with being a public administrator. And if you're there for yourself, to better yourself, to better your condition, it goes back to my old adage, nobody has the right to put on the cloak of authority and then use that cloak of authority to better himself. So that's not my style. And I've done pretty well business-wise without it all. If I had the 20,000 first and the 38,000, heck, I probably would have spent it foolishly somewhere and not have any notice of it at all. But you have to leave office with a clean heart, you see, with a clear conscience.
It's come into office that way, too.
Well, especially. Well, I'll tell you, if we're all, if
that's a great legacy. It's been most enjoyable.
If we're through,
Rich, do you have any questions?
If we're all through, I want to take you fellas to lunch.
That was one honest lunch, a great lunch, and it was also that interview was TV, shot for TV. We have it in the can. Haven't decided quite what to do with it. Anyway, this is a question. It doesn't only apply to San Francisco or even to California, or beyond California. It applies what George Christopher said. He ran in the primary, gubernatorial primary against Ronald Reagan and lost. He was a moderate Republican. Ronald Reagan was to the right, and, of course, he won. But George Christopher had a brilliant diplomatic troubleshooter career, business career, local, what I call civic statesman, and one of the most beloved and most honest, ethical, and competent mayor California has ever seen. And we have a mayor going into the gubernatorial office in Sacramento, Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor. The last San Francisco mayor who won the governorship was a guy named Sonny Jim Rolfe. He was Anglo-Saxon, Episcopal religion. I don't know how well he practiced. He was a notorious cockfighter. I have a picture of him, and I can't find it. Well, we'll put it up when we do find it. In the penthouse of the St. Francis Hotel, he would fight cocks, and he's a big, fat slob. And fortunately for the state of California, he died in office. He ran for governor, and he won during the Depression, about the same time as Will Rogers was talking about government plans. So, but this applies, and decent, real journalists across the country and people who are concerned about public corruption, no matter where you live, how you live, this is the question that should be asked of every person who goes into public office, no matter where they are or who they are, that are they coming into office in one status financially and leaving office much enriched, like a growing number of politicians are today. And that's one way to not change but to reform. And that's another thing. One of the political fictions, uses of language in this last election was, quote, change. What have we changed? We see the same old faces. The only thing that's been changed is the party labels. The real issue and the real question should be reform. That I believe, and a growing number of thinking people believe, that not only San Francisco, California, the nation, is ready for reform, but we should be ready for renaissance. That there's still a lot of creative talent in this country, a lot of people who want to do things. There are even immigrants like Otto Butz, George Christopher came here as an infant, who've come here and have contributed. They have not come here corrupted or compromised people, and this is what we've seen with people like Juan Pifere, Kevin Ryan, from the corrupt judge who's involved in the Steve Mary case, which we will get into in a few minutes. We've had these people who come here and who manipulate the system and try to tell us, in effect, how to run our country. This is our country, and it's a country also of people who have come here from other countries and who come here and embraced our ideals and their practice, what we preach. People like Trevor Hodges, who was born in England, served in Gallipoli and also at the Somme, and then in World War II became a colonel in the U.S. Army, and married. He lost his wife, and he died. And fortunately, I got the only interview he ever did. Nobody knew about him. Ironically, I had to go to Australia to find out about him, and he was living in San Jose, California. And we've run some of his interviews. Now, upcoming this year, we're still kind of fumbling around because we're using the Skype system, but I haven't figured out how to use it. We will have a lot of the archival stuff and new stuff. For instance, those of us who have pets, dogs and cats, are concerned about what, you know, even your pet is what he eats or she eats. And more and more we're seeing on the grocery shelves what is passed off as organic or natural. And several years ago, I did an interview with Dr. Broderick, who made so much money with his cornucopia pet food. I don't know what he's doing today. He made so much money he could afford polo ponies, and he was into veterinary nutrition, which there's the only one course in nutrition was taught in the veterinary schools at the time he went to veterinary school back, I think he went to Cornell. So it's like lawyers, they have one course in ethics, and then after they graduate and then pass the bar, some of them should keep passing. They've forgotten what ethics are, or just discard ethics. And we'll get into that also in another day. But, you know, people are confused. And, you know, even if you're a label reader, when you see such things as, quote, digest, I learned the hard way that when they say chicken digest could be feathers, tips of wings, feet, all kinds of strange things that, you know, you wouldn't buy if you saw, if it was specifically laid out, printed on the label. I remember being up in Midland, Michigan. There was two things up there. I was going up to visit a friend in Ontario, Canada. And there was Dow Chemical, and there was a pet food plant. I don't know which one it was, but the smell was so foul. And I understand one of the worst environmental smells, offensive smells, is sawmills, lumber mills, where they cut a lot of lumber. We have that like at Scotia up in Northern California, or anybody who lives around the lumber mills, there's that peculiar smell. It's really piercing to the nostrils. And also pet food. And God knows what's going into some of this pet food, or what has gone into some of this pet food. And we're learning, this is not a broadcast, I haven't seen it in the news today, but on BBC yesterday, we've learned that there's a major shutdown of food farms in Germany because dioxins somehow got mixed in with industrial offal or waste that is fed, that was put into animal feed. And so that's how this stuff gets into the food chain. So, you know, dioxin is causes cancer and other diseases and afflictions to human beings and to animals. And it's very dangerous, and it's around in a long time, like a nuclear waste. So this is, you know, these are some of the things that people should be aware of. And, you know, the media, if they did their job, whether it's alternative or corporate media, and alternative media can be just as bad, if not worse, such as some of the things that the San Francisco Bay Guardian has done. And we'll get into that another day, another show. What they lie, distort, omit, and they protect their friends, which is usually the wrong type of people, and you wouldn't want them as your friends. But these are things that people should know about because dioxin, you know, if it wasn't for BBC, we wouldn't have heard about that. Also, there was also a report that around the world, I don't know if this is avian flu or what, but a lot of birds are in effect dropping out of the sky. At least that's the report. So we don't know if there's some kind of biological warfare going on, or if it's avian flu or what. But people need to know these things, you know, because you've got to be on guard. Ignorance is not bliss. What you don't know can hurt, harm, and cost you, and will. Today, January 7th, here's some interesting birthdays. We have one of the most mediocre presidents in history. In fact, the street's named after him in San Francisco. And Bill Graham, who was actually a Jewish refugee from, I think, Lithuania, did a lot to promote the early rock bands, the Grateful Dead and that, at a place called the Fillmore, and there was one in New York also. But Millard Fillmore was born today, and, of course, his claim to fame is that he was one of the worst presidents, one of the most ineffectual in the history of the presidency. We also have Saint Bernadette. She was born today, and, of course, she was the saint that the Roman Catholic saint who was discovered, or the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to her at Lourdes, where people go to get cured sometimes. And then we had, who else was born today? Oh, yes, the anchor who took over from over at CBS, Nightly News, Katie Couric, was born in 1957, I think, in Arlington, Virginia. I don't think it was a cemetery, although some of her critics think she belongs there. We also have Nicolas Cage was born today, the actor. He changed his name. He's actually a Coppola, and he wanted to go out on his own and not use the family name. His uncle is a composer who composed the music to The Godfather and other music for movies, and of course he's the brother, the younger brother of the other Coppola, who was the great producer, director, and also a vintner. Has some very fine wine, but it's a little out of our price range. And then among the interesting deaths on this date, Catherine of Aragon, who was an interesting marriage. She was betrothed to the older brother of Henry VIII. In those days, what happened was because of these arranged marriages, because of the dynastic trying to ensure the continuation of the dynasty, Henry VIII's older brother died. So this should not have happened, but they requested a dispensation from the Pope for Henry VIII, the younger brother, to marry Catherine of Aragon. Now, Henry was he was brilliant. He was called Defender of the Faith. He spoke Latin. He composed music. He wrote very well. But he had an immense ego, and Catherine of Aragon could not have a male child. I think a lot of them were stillborn, and of course, medical science wasn't then what it is as advanced today. And so he tried to get a divorce from the Pope, and the Pope said, no, we already gave you one dispensation, and you're not getting another, and there's no way around this. So he started, he broke away from the church and set himself up as the defender of the faith. And whenever a British monarch is crowned, that's in the coronation oath, defender of the faith, but it comes from the Roman Catholic title that Henry VIII had. And so when Queen Elizabeth II dies, and if William ascends the throne and not Prince Charles, who's her son, but rather William, her grandson, part of the coronation oath that he will utter will be a defender of the Anglican faith, unless by that time they reunite with Rome, and that's a possibility. And another great Englishman died today, Trevor Howard, great actor with this kind of gravelly voice. He died today and did a lot of World War II films. Someone else out of World War II, and actually one of the longest reigning Japanese emperors, 62 years he reigned, Hirohito, who some people thought was a thing, and still think today, was a war criminal. And General MacArthur, who had, a lot of people don't know this, MacArthur had, he was the son of General Edward MacArthur, a Civil War hero. He had been to Japan before the end of World War II, and so he understood, at least he thought he did, the Japanese character. And that great book by Manchester, American Caesar, if you're into history, I recommend you read that. He prevented Hirohito from being put on trial as a war criminal. And a lot of people, a lot of prisoners of war who survived Bataan, Corregidor, and the Manchurian, those who Americans and Brits who were tested on in that awful, by General Major Ishii, who used them as who behaved like Dr. Mengele did in the concentration camps. Now, it's interesting. Had Hitler been taken alive, he would certainly have been tried as a war criminal. And that's what the Stalin wanted to do with him, and for a lot of other reasons. Now, among the events today, this is important out of Elizabethan history, and he's supposed to be, some people think he's the author of the Shakespeare plays, and Francis Bacon, who was born on January 22nd, he died, interestingly. He was quite a scholar, a legal background. He was named Lord Chancellor of England. Got into some trouble, political as usual, but he always managed to land on his feet. And he caught pneumonia by trying to freeze a chicken to see if he could freeze food so that it would last longer. So he was ahead of his time, and I think he caught a bad cold or pneumonia. And then more English and European history, Peter the Great, the father of the Russian Navy, he left England, left the Netherlands, where he was learning shipbuilding, and he came to England, and he was traveling around Europe and trying to keep his hand on the pulse of what was going on in Russia, which he was trying to reform. And there's a movie out, was put out in the late 80s, Peter the Great, I think NBC put it out, and it's quite accurate in his history, although it didn't get into his death. He's another one who died of pneumonia. He, at St. Petersburg, the city that he was building as his window on the west, there was a sailor who was marooned or who was shipwrecked or was facing drowning in winter weather. Peter the Great went out to save him and saved him, but in the process caught pneumonia or cold and died. Quite a man. He was very tall, and he did what he wanted. He was the only guy to beat the Swedes. Charles XII, I think it was. Sweden was the preeminent military power on the continent at that time, and Charles XII was also supposedly gay. He was the most brilliant Swedish general of his time, and probably and then Gustavus Adolphus. But he was defeated at the Battle of Pultowa by the Russians, and the Swedes were always fighting because the Russians wanted to get a window on the west and to break out of the Baltic, and the Swedes just wanted to keep them bottled up, and the Swedes and the Russians were always fighting, and finally Peter the Great defeated them at the Battle of Pultowa. And that was the end. Sweden never arose to military supremacy on the continent after that, and they've always been relatively neutral, although they were a base for the OSS during World War II in a famous movie, Counterfeit Traitor. There's an interesting episode in that film, which is accurate, about how the Danes used bicycles to prevent the Gestapo from capturing somebody they were chasing. That's quite interesting. That was probably the first instance of what was going on in San Francisco today, where the bicyclists block all the roads because they want to make a point that bicycles should own the roads, or that's what they think. Also today, in 1896, Arkansas and Mississippi, after the Civil War in 1868, had a constitutional convention. I don't know what they did at that, but that's an important date. Also, in 1896, those of you who like cooking, Fanny Farmer came out with her first book. And then in 1904, those of us who were into radio and communications, Marconi, the guy who was one of the first wireless people, established the International Distress Signal, which is CQD. So if you're out there on the ocean and you're floundering or your ship's sinking or whatever, and you've got a radio man, he's sending out that signal. I don't know if they sent that out at the time of the Titanic. They did a lot of, there was a lot of blunders. That ship could have been, the people on that ship, a lot more could have been saved, so they say. And in 1944, after the Germans had invented the first jet fighter, America came out with the Bell P-59, and we've been fairly preeminent in the jet field ever since. And then among the last things that the Truman administration did in 1953 was to promote the development of the hydrogen bomb. And the father of the hydrogen bomb was a Hungarian Jew named Edward Teller, who was very hardline, and, of course, having survived pogroms and all the other things that went on in Hungary, can understand somewhat where he was coming from. And then one of the greatest operatic singers, the greatest singers in modern history, a black woman named Marian Anderson. For years she was blocked. During the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to give her a permit to sing at a hall that they owned. So Eleanor Roosevelt arranged for her to sing, I think, in an outdoor event in Washington, so as to tell those Daughters of the American Revolution where they could stick their hall. And then this is something that I experienced in 1963. Stamps were raised from 4 cents to 5 cents, and what are they today? Even with and I kept saying this all the time, we were told that the unlimited stamps or the forever stamps, that the post office would never have to seek another postal increase and raise the price of stamps. But I've said this several times, and we've seen what's happened now. Stamps are have gone a long way from 4 cents to 44 cents. And let's see what else we have here. This, I'm sorry about this screw-up. I got to find out what happened when I uploaded that interview on circumcision, and we'll get into that because it's fascinating. Now, one medical fact about circumcision is that it's supposed to prevent or help prevent AIDS and other communicable sexual diseases. Of course, people and condoms don't always prevent transmittal of sexual diseases. So it's something that's controversial, but it's an issue, a medical issue that still should be dealt with. There's been some horrible cases. I know there was a kid I met years ago, my age. It happened in Canada. He was butchered. He lost part of his penis at a circumcision done in a government hospital in Canada. And, of course, they did settle, and then the family emigrated to the United States. So he had very sharp feelings on the subject of circumcision. And there have been some other butcheries. In fact, there's a case I came across in researching the Steve Neri case, and that's still going on. There's an article on the Internet by Jack Cashel, who had part of the Stephen Neri, U.S. Navy sailor story in What's the Matter with California, and God knows there's a lot, a hell of a lot. I told him, I said, I think you should write a chapter on What's the Matter with San Francisco. He said he wouldn't know where to start, and certainly where to finish. Anyway, on that book, and this is interesting, Mary Madeline, the wife of the Raging Cajun Carville, who interestingly was born in Minnesota, and then going to Louisiana as a child, and he served in the Marine Corps for 2 years. Mary Madeline, the editor, she was the editor for this book, so I don't know what she's going to do. She has a law degree, and she's from, I think, somewhere in Indiana. A good editor. Anyway, what was I going to say? So the the Steve Neri case is still going on, and we'll be putting up how this conviction was, how they accomplished it in the corrupt San Francisco DA's office by use of fraudulent documents to get him off the ship and abusing him for 3.5 years and getting away with it, and then having a kangaroo court trial, which had a jury. Now, this is what's so unusual, very unusual, that when the case was removed to the proper jurisdiction of the federal court, the clerk of the San Francisco Superior Court released to me the names of the jurors, since I was the legal liaison to the Navy on this case. And we traced, looked at the backgrounds of some of these people, and it could be suspected that at least one of them was not even a U.S. citizen, but was sitting on a U.S. Jury in this horrible case. And another one, this woman, Motamed, she surfaced in the gay-lesbian marriage spectacle at San Francisco City Hall. She is working in our nuclear program, and she's from Iran, and there's questions of national security about why is this lesbian working in our nuclear program. We, you know, and especially in Iranian, you know, and then participating in a kangaroo court jury. Something very wrong there. So we'll try to find out what happened to that interview. And let's end with our favorite topic. Here we go.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Okay,
Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big Ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about
Republican who's willing to lose.
I suppose we should make Jack Riley the guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of jacks, bet out.
Politics and polka, politics and polka, shuffle up the cards and find the joker. Neither game for children, neither game is rough. Decisions, decisions, like
who to pick,
how to play, not to bet,
when to call a bluff.
All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Paratrace.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try like a Vanyachinkovic. I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.
We could run out Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot!
Politics and poker, politics and poker, play for a pot that's mediocre. Politics and poker, rubbing neck and neck. If politics seems more predictable, that's because usually you can stack the deck. Politics and poker, politics and poker, make the average
you know, politics and poker, we get the, in political etymology, we get the term smoke-filled room. And, of course, this is how the political bosses used to sit around playing poker, you know, smoking cigars, stogies, drinking whiskey. And, of course, during the Harding, when Warren G. Harding was selected, that's when the term came to the, I think, to the forefront. Of course, can you imagine Nancy Pelosi, Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi, sitting around playing poker with Steny Hoyer, John Boehner, who's that guy, Senate Majority Leader, and some others? Wouldn't that be a sight? Nancy Pelosi playing poker, high-stakes poker. She's done that with a lot of political programs. That would be interesting. Or even Mr. O. I don't know if he's a card player. You know. So we'll hope to get this mess straightened out. On this is the second time it's happened, and something keeps interfering when we try to go on the air. Try to work that out. And we have about 1,000 interviews I've done, a wide variety of Dr. Michael Fox, the head of the RSCPA, the guy who did the Roger Karras, who did the American Kennel Association shows at Westminster, and we're coming up to the great Westminster Dog Show and then the Crufts in London, and a lot of other things. I'm not only Greenpeace, I stayed with some Greenpeace when I was in Australia, and I couldn't wait to have a real piece of meat, not kangaroo meat. And let's see, who else we have? The Sea Shepherd did an interview with them when they were in San Francisco. So there's a lot coming up and a lot of historical stuff, and we want to thank you for listening, and this will remain up in the archives, and also we'll have Pat Butler back I don't know what he's hatching. It gets pretty cold in Chicago. And people are wondering about, didn't Bloomberg learn a lesson from Mayor Blandick, who's the guy who succeeded Richard Daley the First, that he was defeated by the snow in the 70s by a woman named Jane Byrne? I mean, the triple B's is kind of funny. So maybe Bloomberg should stop playing around at that mosque and pay attention to basic city services. Richard Daley would never been caught in that kind of a situation. This is Peter Paul Brazola. Thank you for listening.